You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 2nd of August 2021 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. This is The Globalist, coming to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead...
If you want to do business with the federal government, get your workers vaccinated. If, in fact, you're unvaccinated, you present a problem to yourself, to your family, and to those with whom you work.
Amid a rising surge of the Delta variant in the US, Joe Biden takes firm action. We'll check in with our Tokyo 2020 correspondent and find out why the highway code is being rewritten. Then...
It's really important in a deep personal way, because you feel like up until you have this full and complete picture, up until you can finally stop asking, could we have done anything differently? Could the state have done anything differently? Then you feel like you can't grieve.
There's some measure of comfort for the son and family of murdered Maltese journalist Daphne Caruana Galizia, as an inquiry finds the government there complicit in her death. But there are still questions to be answered. Also ahead, we'll round up news from the world of aviation, have a scan of the front pages, plus, as Spotify announces a new model, we'll ask if monetizing podcasts will be good for the industry or will damage the listenership. That's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. The military leader of Myanmar, General Min Aung Hlaing, has extended the country's state of emergency by 2 years and named himself as prime minister. The United States and the United Kingdom have blamed Iran for an attack that killed two people on an oil tanker off the coast of Oman on Thursday. And wildfires continue to rage across southern Europe amid an intense heat wave, which shows no signs of abating. In Italy, firefighters are struggling to contain around 800 separate blazes. Do stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on those stories. But first, just under half the American population has been vaccinated against coronavirus, and there's now a push to increase this amid the surge of the Delta variant. President Biden has called for new measures to address what he's calling the pandemic of the unvaccinated. Suzanne Lynch, Washington correspondent for the Irish Times, sent this report.
Just a few months ago, the United States was leading the world on vaccine rollout. But last week, the European Union surpassed America in terms of the number of vaccines administered. So, what's gone wrong with America's vaccination program? According to experts, America is now facing a dual problem: the emergence of the new, more infectious Delta variant, and vaccine skepticism among large parts of the population. Delta now accounts for almost all new infections in the United States, with the 7-day average of cases now standing at around 74,000. In addition, President Joe Biden is faced with entrenched vaccine hesitancy among many Americans. CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky recently warned of a pandemic of the unvaccinated. There are huge regional variations across the United States. In some parts of the country, for example in the Northeast, more than 80% of adults are vaccinated. States in the South, like Mississippi and Alabama, have seen vaccine rates hovered around 40%. Unsurprisingly, in states with the lowest level of vaccination, the number of new cases is higher. In a fresh push to increase vaccination levels, President Biden has urged states and local leaders to offer unvaccinated Americans $100 to get the jab, noting that previous financial incentives like this led to an increase in vaccine take-up. He has also announced new requirements for all federal workers and contractors to show proof of vaccination or face more restrictions such as testing and limits on work travel. He has encouraged the private sector to follow suit. Last week, the CDC introduced new guidance recommending that vaccinated as well as unvaccinated people should wear masks in certain indoor settings. Many states have introduced even stricter requirements, mandating the wearing of masks in all indoor environments, for example, in Washington, D.C. Such moves are politically contentious, with many Republicans objecting to the new rules. But the main message coming from the White House is that vaccination remains the most effective way to guard against serious illness and death. Whether the millions of doubtful Americans are listening remains to be seen.
Suzanne Lynch, Washington correspondent for the Irish Times there. Well, Scott Lucas, adjunct professor at the Clinton Institute, University College Dublin, joins me on the line now to discuss this. Scott, what is behind this vaccine hesitancy in the United States?
Well, Georgina, there can be a number of reasons. And I have a close relative who, even though she's a cancer survivor, is still refusing to get the vaccine. It could be on occasion, and in her case, for religious reasons. It could be in some cases because people are dedicated anti-vaxxers. It could be in some cases because they simply don't like the Biden administration because it's Democratic or, you know, because it's, quote, extremist. But the underlying factor is this poisonous disinformation, which, of course, has been around since the start of the pandemic and which was reinforced, of course, by the previous occupant of the White House. When people read on the internet and believe that Bill Gates or George Soros are rolling out vaccines to control them and to control the world, when they read unfounded claims that the vaccines lead to mass deaths, when they read beyond vaccines claims, not only from right-wing attack sites, but from people on, say, for example, Fox TV, that masks are useless, when they read attacks on the very public health and medical experts that are trying to tell them how to save their lives, then it reinforces that it's not vaccine hesitancy, it's vaccine denial.
And is this political then, Scott? I mean, you mentioned the previous occupant of the White House. We know that Trump himself was very hesitant about wearing a mask. Are the people who are refusing it generally his supporters, or who is driving this misinformation?
Well, I mean, again, misinformation and disinformation vaccines existed before Donald Trump. But let's be clear here that Trumpists are at the forefront of this campaign against vaccines and against containment measures. You can see that, for example, again, on right-wing attack sites, Breitbart, Town Hall, PJ Media, and on Fox TV every single night, who are accusing not only Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris, but, for example, the top coronavirus, Dr. Anthony Fauci, of being basically criminals. And that term criminal has been used, including by a Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, when addressing Fauci. But again, it's not just those right-wing outlets. When you talk about a governor like Ron DeSantis of Florida, diehard Trumpist, wants to be president in 2024, who last week came out and dismissed any containment measures, even though Florida has 20% of all new cases in the United States, you realize, yes, this is a deeply political issue, which is exacerbating the harm, or has exacerbated the harm so far, to Americans.
And is there a racial element to it, too?
Yeah, again, we should acknowledge that it's not just vaccine denial that has caused problems, especially in the early stages of the vaccine rollout. The question of getting the vaccine to all Americans, including poor Americans, including people of color in America, was a huge issue. But by and large, not just the federal government, but especially state and local governments working with federal authorities have really tackled that. Now, there is still vaccine denial amongst other communities who are not Trumpist. It still is an issue of getting information out there. But I think that in those communities, amongst people of color, you are seeing this, in other words, being dealt with, even though we still have a ways to go.
Mm. And we've heard about some of the measures that Biden has called for. Are these enshrined by law or are they just suggestions?
No, some of the measures are within his purview. So, for example, Suzanne Lynch in that excellent summary, talked about Biden last week saying that federal workers must get the jab, or they must observe containment measures such as masking and social distancing, and there will be some limitations, for example, limits on their ability to travel on federal business. There is talk, and I think it will happen, that federal contractors, so private businesses who work for the U.S. government, their workers will also have to meet the same conditions. Other suggestions, however, are not in his purview, but they are with the state and local governments. So the $100, which he has asked to be given to people who now complete the two doses of vaccination, that is something that state and local governments would have to roll out. Some of them, I think, will do so. Others, of course, who are led by Trumpist governors, undoubtedly will not.
And I mean, I wonder if these new measures can stamp out the virus, or are there, as has been suggested, other variants likely to emerge? And I mean, those variants are likely to come from countries where there's very poor vaccine take up. Where is the US on providing vaccines for those countries?
First of all, Georgina, and I'm guided here by medical and public health experts, their assessment is that we won't stamp out COVID virus, just as we won't stamp out the flu. It's a question of being able to contain and to be able to live with this by reducing the deaths, by reducing the hospitalizations. Undoubtedly, that has to be a global effort. And one of the barriers has been getting the vaccines to other countries. Now, the U.S. earlier this year made a commitment through Joe Biden to provide several hundred million doses of the vaccine to other countries. But the sticking point, the real question, according to experts, is, look, if you really want this to be a global effort to contain the virus and to limit it, you need to have the transfer of vaccine technology so people can manufacture their own vaccines and not just be dependent on handouts. And there are entrenched interests, political and corporate interests, that are against what would effectively be the waiving of patents and transferring technology so other countries can join the U.S. and the U.K. in trying to get a massive vaccine rollout.
And finally, Scott, what is the current state of travel in and out of the U.S.?
This is a personal issue for me, Georgina, because I've been trying since October 2019 to get back to the U.S. to see my parents, who are in their 80s, going into the United States. I still can't do so. As a U.S. citizen, I can get into the country, but I still would have to quarantine for a period of time, which makes any visit almost useless at this point. And those conditions have been reinforced, especially for non-U.S. citizens in recent weeks because of the Delta variant. In other countries, in some other countries such as the U.K., who are very much trying to boost their economies, they are relaxing the restrictions on travelers from the United States. So the UK government, as an example, has said if you're doubly vaccinated from the United States, you will not need to quarantine from this month.
Scott, thank you very much indeed. That is Scott Lucas there. A new report has found the Maltese government complicit in the death of Daphne Caruana Galizia, the journalist who led the Panama Papers investigation into corruption in Malta. Caruana Galizia died in a car bomb attack near her home in October 2017, sparking a political crisis in the country and leading to the resignation of the Prime Minister, Joseph Muscat, in 2019 after his close associates were implicated. The report has been welcomed by the organisation Reporters Without Borders, or RSF, whose Director of International Campaigns, Rebecca Vincent, joins me now. Rebecca, thanks for coming on. Can we start by you telling us more about Daphne Caruana Galizia and the work that she was involved in before her murder?
Absolutely. So Daphne Caruana Galizia was Malta's most prominent journalist. She was fearless. She was courageous, really. She had a blog where she would blog about many people in the island, including public officials, including others of public interest. And her tone, really, she pulled no punches. And so she certainly had caught the attention of many people in power. But she was also a serious investigative journalist. And you mentioned already the Panama Papers investigations. She single-handedly exposed much corruption in the island and, you know, was loved by many and also hated by many for it. And so she was killed in October 2017, which was shocking at the time, remains shocking to this day that something like this could happen in broad daylight in an EU state. And nearly 4 years on, we all continue the campaign for justice, because although there has been progress and this report is a step towards justice, still much remains to be done to ensure accountability for this heinous attack.
So what were the findings of the report?
So the report, it's very encouraging. In fact, this public inquiry has been a long time coming. In fact, the Maltese government under the administration of Joseph Muscat, the former prime minister, really resisted establishing this until the last possible minute when it was really pressured to do so, in particular by the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe. The Board of Public Inquiry thoroughly and independently and robustly examined thorough evidence and took testimony for many months in this. And so the report that has come out now is over 400 pages in Maltese, and the findings are damning. It found that the state does have some responsibility for what happened to Daphne, that they should have recognized the threats and the climate for what they were. They could have acted to protect her, to prevent this assassination. And so we're still combing through everything. We're waiting for the full English translation here. But there is a series of recommendations here which will prove really important, getting at both the systemic things that have happened here and ensuring that change is made so that this can't happen to somebody else. But also there's specific recommendations with regard to the protection of journalists in Malta. And so I want to highlight that point too, because this inquiry was intended not only to establish the truth about what happened to Daphne, but also to draw lessons about how to protect journalists going forward. And that remains really important, because journalists who continue to work in Malta, especially those who do this sort of in-depth investigative reporting that Daphne did, remain at high risk.
Mm. And so what's the role of your organisation, RSF, in A, driving the inquiry, but B, also, as you say, ensuring journalists in Malta are kept safe and the government is held to account?
So we've been involved in the campaign for justice since the immediate aftermath of Daphne's assassination. But I really want to emphasize that her wonderful family has really led efforts. And so we've been working to support them, to amplify what they're doing. We've been working in coordination with a group of international NGOs. And, you know, coordinating with their Maltese lawyers and international lawyers as well, and making sure to work with the local and international media as well. So it's really been one of the most successful examples so far of a well-organized, coordinated campaign that I've ever worked on. But it's really important that we stick with this. And so our role now, I think, as Reporters Without Borders will specifically be to, A, to ensure that this that the findings of this inquiry get international attention as well, and to encourage international policymakers, including international organizations, which Malta is a part of, and other states that it has bilateral relations with, encouraging them to hold Malta to account for this, and then encouraging the Maltese authorities directly as well to implement these really important recommendations from this report.
I mean, it does seem, though, that in some places the public are actively encouraged to see journalists as enemies. I mean, there are examples of this across the world. The government of Zimbabwe branded me an enemy of the state for telling the truth. Here in Britain, we recently saw a reporter attacked by an anti-lockdown mob. There are so many examples. How can and should governments protect the safety of journalists?
You're absolutely right. And in fact, that very trend is still happening in Malta, where the media climate remains highly divided. And there are attempts to attack and isolate, you know, critical journalists there still. It happens everywhere. And the problem is when it happens in our democratic states and there's no really move towards accountability for that, it sets this negative example that, you know, those with you know, more sinister intentions in other parts of the world will very much look at a country like the UK. And if we have that same problem happening here, we'll point to that as an excuse, and it will enable them sometimes to even, you know, blur the lines between this sort of rhetoric and actual physical attacks or moves such as imprisonment or other forms of pressure. So I think in the first instance, it has to be recognized that, you know, this sort of climate, it's not just words. So often now we're seeing a very clear pattern of harassment, of threats and abuse before more drastic steps are taken, such as a physical attack like what happened to Daphne. That's really important from this finding, is that the Board of Public Inquiry has pointed to this climate, saying, look, there was a clear pattern here that, you know, that there were signs that this could have happened and that the state failed in its responsibility. So it's not necessarily just a question of being able to connect direct dots from a government to a murder of a journalist, but this responsibility for that climate. So we can't take that for granted anywhere. And indeed, in the UK, we still haven't quite got it good enough here. And when that sort of language is coming from public officials themselves, it really undermines any other efforts that our own states might be taking to protect journalists or promote global media freedom.
Rebecca, thank you very much for that. Now, still to come on the programme, the Highway Code gets a makeover, Spotify changes its business model, and we round up the latest aviation news. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
We head now to Tokyo to join Kieran Pender, Monocle's Olympics correspondent. Kieran, hello to you. What have you eaten today?
I was on a 5 a.m. bus south of Tokyo heading to the track cycling velodrome. So I had to get some convenience food late last night. And then I've just had a hamburger at the media center restaurant. So it hasn't been a day of culinary highlights, I'm afraid.
But convenience food is what an article in the New York Times is all about. Apparently, it's all the rage.
Yeah, so one of the funny quirks of this Olympics is that journalists aren't allowed out of our bubble for the first 14 days of being here. So we're allowed to go to Olympic venues and our hotel, but we can't go to restaurants and bars as a result of the COVID situation. But we are allowed for 15 minutes each day to a convenience store near our respective hotels. That has meant that the 7-Elevens and the Lawsons of Tokyo have been the main dining spot for 5,000 or so journalists from around the world in the last 2 weeks.
Well, this New York Times article absolutely raves about them, the Konbini.
Yeah, I'm perhaps not as upbeat about it into my 12th day, I think, of convenience store food. But certainly it is very fortunate in the circumstances that the Konbinis of Japan are so well stocked with all sorts of sort of instant food, both catering to Japanese tastes and other palates. But I am looking forward to getting out of my bubble in this week ahead and hopefully having some proper food.
But of course, anybody who exits the bubble without the right permission gets into huge trouble. And there has been an example of that.
Yeah, we saw two Georgian judokas, so people who participate in the sport of judo, have been ordered to leave the Olympics for breaking COVID rules at the Games. They'd finished their competition and wanted to go sightseeing, and I think their defence is that they walked out of the village and that there were no guards and no one told them they couldn't. However, we have been being told for the past few months that we're not allowed to leave our bubbles, so I'm not sure that excuse really stands up to scrutiny. They've been sent home from Tokyo, although it's not the worst punishment given they were going home in the first place anyway. But it is a good example of how bizarre these games are. You know, normally the Olympics are about bringing people together, cultural exchange. Normally host nations can't get enough of Olympians getting out and about in the public, meeting locals, bringing that Olympic cheer. And now we have two Georgians being disciplined and sanctioned and sent home for just trying to see the sights of Tokyo.
But there have been some reasons to celebrate, particularly for your home nation, Australia.
Australia on Sunday had its best ever day at the Games with 4 gold medals, best ever day in history. And it was a particularly sweet day for one of our swimmers, Emma McKeon. She's won 7 medals in Tokyo, including 4 gold medals. That makes her one of only 2 women in the history of the Olympics, in our history in modern times. That goes back to 1896, one of only 2 women in that time to win 7 medals in one game. Only 2 men, Michael Phelps, the US swimmer being the most notable, have gone better with 8. McKeon just had a brilliant week and capped off a really fantastic Sunday for Australia.
Now, there is a new sport at the Olympics this year. Well, in fact, there are several new sports, but one of them quite controversial. People wonder if BMX should really be there.
This Olympics has really been characterised by some amazing additions to the program. We've had skateboarding, we've had surfing. This week we're going to see some sport climbing. One real highlight over the weekend was BMX freestyle. Now, BMX racing, when BMX riders race around a track, has been on the program for a number of Olympics now. BMX freestyle, on the other hand, is people on these small BMX bikes. They have 60 seconds in a skate park arena to pull as many tricks and flips as they can, and they get a score for that, and they get 2 60-second runs and only the best counts. Absolutely incredible scenes of people pulling, you know, front flips, back flips, side to side, the most amazing aerial gymnastics you've seen. A really beautiful story, Charlotte Worthington from the UK. She used to work in a Mexican restaurant in Manchester, picked up BMX freestyle, and now is the Olympic champion for Australia. One of those four medals I mentioned came from Logan Martin, the world champion in that discipline. Really never seemed likely to finish anywhere but first. But really warmly received, I think, by the media here in Tokyo, by the athletes and by spectators all around the world. And I think BMX freestyle, like surfing, like skateboarding, have found a new home at the Olympics, and I'd be very surprised not to see it back on the program in Paris in 3 years' time.
And finally, Italy has continued its winning streak after its Euro victory. It's doing extremely well at the Olympics too.
Yeah, there were two really beautiful stories last night. So I was at the Olympic Stadium watching the 100-metre final, and we saw Marcel Jacobs of Italy, born in the US, brought up in Italy, won the 100 metres, really came from nowhere. He was a former long jumper, switched to 100 metres and has won the first 100-metre dash of the post-Usain Bolt era in quite a spectacular final. But only 5 or 10 minutes before his victory, we saw a Italian high jumper claim equal gold. There were two high jumpers level on the same height of 2 meters and 37, and they were asked, you know, whether they wanted to have a jump off. They both had their three unsuccessful jumps at a higher height. The rules say the next is a jump off between the two, and they said they didn't want to. They're very close friends. They've spoken about each other supporting each other through hard times, and so they said, actually, we don't want to jump off. We want to share the gold medal. Beautiful scenes at the Olympic Stadium and a really special night for Italy.
Heartwarming stuff. Kieran Pender in Tokyo. Thank you very much indeed. Here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. The military leader of Myanmar, General Min Aung Hlaing, has extended the country's state of emergency by 2 years and named himself as Prime Minister. The United States and the United Kingdom have blamed Iran for an attack that killed two people on an oil tanker off the coast of Oman on Thursday. And wildfires continue to rage across southern Europe amid an intense heat wave which shows no sign of abating. In Italy, firefighters are struggling to contain around 800 separate blazes. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. The Highway Code, a set of information, advice, guides and mandatory rules for road users in the UK promoting road safety, was first published in 1931 and it's been regularly updated ever since. The latest version puts pedestrians at the top of a new road user hierarchy. Well, joining me now to discuss this is Monocle's Nick Moniz. Nick, good morning to you and thanks for coming on. What are the major proposed changes and which of them is most significant?
Well, I mean, I guess you touched on the most important one there, Georgina, the hierarchy of responsibility. But I'll come back to that one because that is, it is quite significant. I mean, there's just some other introductions that are important. There's now minimum overtaking distances, say, when a car is passing a cyclist or a pedestrian. So, I mean, the old rule vaguely said that drivers had to give cyclists as much room as they would when overtaking a car, but I guess that's kind of vague without any specific distance, which sort of left it up to the driver's discretion. And maybe if you've not ridden a bike before, you might not realise how uncomfortable it is to have a car come close to you. So that's resulted in a new minimum distance set for overtaking. So it's 1.5 meters when overtaking a bike at speeds under 30 miles an hour, 2 when you're over 30. And if you're a large vehicle like a lorry or a truck, you've got to pass at 2 meters. There's also been, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Dutch Reach.
No.
Okay. It sounds vaguely sinister to me every time I hear it, but there's also a new rule advising people essentially to open their car doors using the hand opposite the door side, if that makes sense. So you kind of have to reach across. If you're opening your right-hand door, you reach across with your left hand, which sort of forces your body to look out across your blind spot and hopefully see if there are any cyclists riding past you there and reduce the chance of hitting them with your car door. So yeah, less creepy than that sounds, but a very important rule. And then I guess the other significant one that you've mentioned there is the hierarchy of responsibility. And what this is about is essentially, I guess, about placing the onus of responsibility for safety on those in charge of the largest vehicles or the vehicles that could do the most damage. So lorry drivers, truck drivers and car owners are now required to reduce the danger, which again may be a little bit of vague terminology, but essentially means drive as safely as possible around more vulnerable users. So starting with pedestrians at the top of that hierarchy is the most vulnerable, followed by cyclists and in a very British move, horse riders as well. So it essentially means that those in charge of the largest vehicles with the potential to cause, I guess, the most harm if there was a crash, are now responsible bear the responsibility to take care and reduce the danger they pose to those around them. And for me, I guess that is quite important because, yeah, it comes back to putting the onus of responsibility on those that can hurt others.
I wonder, was there anything about e-scooters?
Nothing on e-scooters because I don't know if you're aware, and this is one of my big gripes, Andrew Miller and I talk about on the briefing as regularly as we are permitted to, but they're not actually legally able to be used on the road. They're considered a toy in the United Kingdom and can only be ridden on private property. So if you want to tut-tut at anyone riding one on the road, just know that they are actually breaking the law.
And what about on the pavement? Because that's where they really are a menace.
Not on the pavement either. I don't believe, I would double check that one, but I don't believe they're allowed to be ridden on the pavement. They're a toy and they're meant to be ridden on private property only.
So are these measures enshrined in law? I mean, is the Highway Code a legal document?
Well, they're not law, but it's one of those ones where it can be used to help establish precedent and liability in a court of law. So it could be used to, say, someone knocked a cyclist off their bicycle. It could be used to establish, I guess, liability that perhaps they weren't, you know, the exact phrase is driving safely or riding reducing the danger, rather, around a cyclist. If that was proven, I guess this code could be used to establish their responsibility in a court of law. But some of them are backed up with actual traffic laws underneath. So, you know, if for instance, that minimum overtaking distance is a law, so that could be enforced. But other ones like the Dutch Reach, like reducing the danger, they are suggestions but can be used to establish liability.
So Nick, what's the overall desired effect of this?
I mean, for me, if I'm looking at it, it's about, I guess, hopefully creating culture change in the United Kingdom where perhaps, you know, bike riders and pedestrians aren't always necessarily treated with respect on the roads. I'm not sure, do you ride your bike, Georgina, or walk, or where, you know, have you ever felt uncomfortable on the roads?
Yes, when overtaking cyclists who just get in the damn way.
Well, now that we've got 1.5 minimum overtaking distance, Georgina, I'm sure we can come to a happy agreement. But I guess it's about, I guess, you know, reminding drivers that I guess bike riders are welcome on the roads. And for me, this is about, I guess, yeah, coming back to, as I said, creating that cultural shift where, you know, perhaps walking and cycling, if they start to feel a little bit safer, more people take to the roads, not e-scooters as we've established, but more people start taking to the roads and you get that change where, you know, with more people bike riding, there's greater respect around other road users and hopefully it's just that sort of flow on effect.
Absolutely. Nick, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That was Nick Manise there. You're listening to The Globalist on Monocle 24 with me, Georgina Godwin. And joining me now down the line is political journalist and author Terry Stiastny to have a look through today's newspapers. Good morning to you, Terry.
Good morning.
So you are down the line because you're away. You're not in London. It's school holidays and you've gone off with your family. Where have you gone?
At the moment, I'm just in the Cotswolds. I'm hoping to go to France later in August. So that means that I am watching with very close interest the story that's the lead story in the Times this morning, which is headlined, Tories Revolt on Amber Watchlist Crackdown on Holidays. Now, to sort of translate that into English for anybody who's not watching this as closely as I am, basically in the UK, there is the rules are being liberalised today. People who are double vaccinated coming from the EU and from the United States now don't have to quarantine if they're coming to Britain. However, there's a sort of so-called traffic light system for people going the other, coming into the country and leaving the country. It's supposed to be very straightforward. Red, you have to quarantine in a hotel. Amber, there's limited restrictions now for people coming from amberless countries. Green, kind of, you're all fine. But now the government is talking about introducing something called an amber watch list, and this has caused many Conservative and other MPs and the travel industry to be very cross, because this means that, you know, that all the countries, say like Spain, Greece or Italy, could move to amber status. That means it, but it could be at risk of going red, and red means you have to spend 10 days in a hotel room quarantined at a cost of £1,700. And one Tory MP is saying this idea is a giant red flag that would cause bookings to collapse, and people making sort of dire warnings about what this uncertainty might mean for the travel industry.
Now, of course, and the industry itself, of course, sounding those same warnings.
Yes, that's right. I mean, they're warning, the travel industry is warning of job losses of up to 200,000 if there isn't a support scheme for after the furlough system ends. And they're suggesting, the airlines are saying that this introduction of possible watch lists are not proven to be an effective method. And that, you know, if you have a traffic light system that it's essentially is quite straightforward and people understand red, amber, green, but if they have, say, amber plus, as you currently have for France, which is although an amber country, you still have to quarantine even though restrictions have been lifted for elsewhere. That may change later this week. There is a confusion and there is a, you know, uncertainty, which means many people don't want to plan travel in case the rules suddenly change.
Yeah. Now, the American military has been travelling en masse out of Afghanistan one way. David Petraeus has been criticising this move, saying Afghanistan has been abandoned to civil war. Tell us more about this.
Yes, this is an interview which he has given to the Times, and he, you know, is really making some quite dire warnings about what is like possibly could happen on the ground. He says that, you know, if the US leaves completely, the rest of the world will see, he says, that we are not supporting democracy or maintaining the values we promote around the world, human rights, particularly women's rights, the right to education and freedom of speech. And he says the worst case scenario is we could see a bloody brutal civil war similar to that in the 1990s when the Taliban prevailed. He's warning about, you know, the risk of Al-Qaeda, the risk of refugees going into Pakistan, and the reductions in freedoms for women. And what he thinks that the US should do, he says, I'm a little bit unclear why we didn't think we could maintain 3,500 troops to stop the Taliban from bringing back an ultra-conservative Islamist theocracy, which is not in anyone's interests. So really extremely critical here of the US position at the moment.
Absolutely. Now, let's cross to the Olympics. We've heard from our Olympic correspondent already today, but we didn't go into this story about the Belarusian athlete who is now being protected by Japanese police.
Yes, this is it's a fascinating story, and it's featured in The Guardian and in many other papers as well. This is about the Belarusian sprinter Kristina Szymanouskaya, who says that she was taken against her will by the Belarusian team officials to Tokyo Airport, where she says she is now being protected by Japanese police and the UN Human Rights Commission, apparently also involved. And she appealed very sort of movingly and directly to the International Olympic Committee to protect her. And she says that she was told that she had to, you know, she criticised her own country's officials, not for sort of the politics, but just for, she said that her, some of her teammates hadn't been given sufficient anti-doping tests, and so she was suddenly put into the 4x400 meters relay. But because she posted about this on Instagram, she was told that her coaching staff came to her room and told her to pack and said, basically, look, you're going home now. And she felt, she didn't feel safe, and she did not want to be suddenly sent home, and is now possibly considering asylum. And some countries have offered her, Poland, the Czech Republic have already offered her asylum, and the Belarusian Sports Solidarity Foundation said she was planning to seek asylum in either Germany or Austria.
Interesting stuff. So much political drama on the edges of the Olympics, not least about those countries in the former Soviet Union. Of course, we've had all the Russian doping accusations, even though Russia is not officially at the Games.
Well, yes, I mean, I think this is perhaps why her post, even though it was about, you know, selections for the team and about sort of how people are complying with the doping rules, I mean, maybe that's why the Belarusian authorities were so hypersensitive about this, because, you know, it says here, she said, the head coach came over to me and said there had been an order from above to remove me. So she's obviously been appealing for international support, and the Belarusian Olympic Committee has blamed her what they called an emotional psychological state and said this was doctor's advice. But it really doesn't seem that that is the case. It seems that, you know, she's made some unwanted criticism, and they wanted to do something about that.
Mm. Finally, Terry, let's look at what's going on in southern Europe with these fires, which are just raging in many, many countries.
Yes, this is a story that is picked up by Le Figaro, which is looking across the whole of southern Europe. And it's really some very dramatic statistics. It said in the last week in the south of Italy, there have been 800 fires that have started. Greece has reported 56 fires. But it's just sort of the scale of some of this. Interestingly, in Turkey, it says here that, you know, they have had fires and across 95,000 hectares this year alone, which compares to only about 13,000 hectares covered, you know, over the recent decade. This is the worst catastrophe in a decade, and President Erdogan has had to ask for help from his Russian and Ukrainian neighbours, and so far they have sent more than 4,000 firefighters, 5 planes, and about 40 helicopters to try and fight some of these fires. This has affected tourist areas, including Bodrum, and 4,000 tourists and staff had to be evacuated by the Coast Guard and by fishing boats. There's still a massive state of alert. Also, you know, some very dramatic pictures here from Sicily, where flames have been raging alongside sort of the beaches, and record temperatures. So, yeah, there's still sort of extreme wariness about whether these fires are spreading and what this tells us about our climate.
Mm. I mean, there was a suggestion in the Turkish media that because a lot of the fires started at exactly the same time, that there could be some form of arson going on. But it would seem, in the face of this heat wave and giant thunderstorms and just the scale of it, that it's happening in so many countries, that this must be climate related.
Yes, I mean, I think some people, again, yes, looking at Sicily as well, they've suggested that some have been started deliberately. But, you know, the fact that just the level of the heat and the number of the fires and the fact that they're happening all across southern Europe. I mean, we've had many years now of high temperatures. But, I mean, it's the article's mostly talking about southern Europe, but it says also northern Europe. So even Finland has had forest fires, which it's not used to having. And it's saying the most devastating fire of the last 50 years, 300 hectares of forest gone up in flames. And so, you know, I think that people really are starting to be concerned about what these changes mean long term for our environment.
Terry, thank you very much indeed. That was Terry Stiastony, and this is The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Now it's time to find out what's happening in the world of Asian aviation with Greg Waldron, who's the Asia Managing Editor at Flight Global. Greg, we've just been hearing about the woes of the travel industry and, of course, one particular sector that's being hit by this are low-cost carriers. Tell us more.
Well, in Southeast Asia has really been a major market for low-cost carriers of the last 20 years, and it's been a booming business. So you have these really iconic chief executives. You know, Tony Fernandez is one. Lion Air's Rusty Khurana is another. And these guys placed, you know, massive orders in the 2010s for aircraft. I mean, I think Lion Air has 426 aircraft in order with, you know, Airbus and Boeing. So that's a massive, you know, piece of business for the airframers, for the engine makers. And then Tony Fernandez, who's the boss of AirAsia, has, I think, about 350 Airbus jets on his order book. But of course, these airlines have been devastated by, you know, COVID-19. The international traffic in the region is all but is gone. The domestic markets are really suffering. And, you know, today we saw news that Lion's are going to be furloughing 8,000 employees. So it's pretty tough right now.
Mm. And in terms of their fleets, are these leased or do they belong to them? And what does that mean for lease payments?
Well, the model typically works that they have these big order books, but it takes so much cash to actually own aircraft that typically what will happen is they'll have the big order book, but then a lessor will step in to actually buy that jet and then they'll lease it back to the airline. And that works very well for the airlines because, you know, they don't have to have a lot of cash tied up in jets. And then lessors, who are often backed by institutional investors, will get a nice, steady, you know, capitalist stream. But since the crisis hit us last year, lease payments have all but stopped. And so both Tony Fernandez and Rusty and the other, you know, major airline CEOs in the region have been in very difficult discussions with the lessors throughout, you know, the major lessors about these payments. So it's a very tricky situation right now in terms of, you know, lease payments because it's really kind of dried up, especially from Southeast Asia.
And what about actually buying the aircraft? Because there must be a big question mark about deliveries.
Yeah, it's certainly true. I mean, Airbus is talking about, you know, hiking its deliveries. But, you know, out here in Southeast Asia, the last thing the airlines really need is new aircraft. I mean, most of the aircraft that they have are actually, you know, parked in long-term storage. And this is for the low-cost carriers as well as for the major airlines in the region. So really, they don't want it. So they're looking at, like, ways to, you know, restructure the number of aircraft that they're going to take, or not the number they're going to take, but, you know, the delivery schedule for these aircraft. Although that said, Tony Fernandez was speaking to the Singapore Foreign Correspondents Association, you know, about 10 days ago, and he said that he's still committed to taking his full order book of jets on the AirAsia side. Not so much for AirAsia X, which is kind of a separate story, but he's still bullish long term on the potential out here.
Mm, but AirAsia is, in fact, restructuring.
They are indeed. So AirAsia X, Lion Air, Malaysia Airlines, a lot of the carriers out here. It's about these major debt restructurings, major restructuring of pretty much everything. And it's a bit of a, you know, it's a very opaque process, you know, the way they're working with the lessors. So you don't really get a lot of visibility on exactly how that's working out. But effectively, though, the, you know, the airline industry has always been very tough. You know, margins have always been very thin. You know, it's a very expensive business to be in, very high fixed costs. And so this crisis has just, you know, made it almost untenable. So it's extremely difficult for the airlines right now.
Let's have a look at China. Quite a bad quarter for Chinese carriers.
Yeah, it is. Well, China's been, curiously, even though the coronavirus outbreak started there, like, in, you know, this is the first place it was detected in early 2020. For the most part, their domestic market has been one of the real bright spots in the world. You know, they have kind of a zero COVID strategy. They're able to really lock things down. And ultimately, that's really benefited Chinese carriers. So in recent quarters, they've actually had, you know, capacity that's been actually exceeded that in 2018, 2019. The airlines aren't flying internationally, but they've been able to really, you know, build up their domestic network. And really, a lot of internal tourism in China, people flying for business. You know, from what I hear, it's just kind of like normal times, as long as you don't, you know, leave China. But now you have these, you know, there's an outbreak in Nanjing. We don't really know a lot about it. You know, the numbers are a bit unclear. And, you know, the Communist Party of China is not very transparent on these things as well. But basically, the Nanjing airport was locked down last week, and a number of airlines stopped flying there. Now, we really don't know what's going on, but if there is the spread of the Delta variant is sort of happening in China, which of course is, it's happening in Australia, it's happening in Singapore, then you could see that strong domestic recovery we've seen in China derailed for a while.
Mm. And Greg, finally, I wonder how optimistic you feel about the recovery of global air travel.
I'm pretty pessimistic for the time being because the Delta variant seems to be really kind of taking off. Like you're having, you know, big outbreaks in the U.S. There's potential for another outbreak in India. Vaccine rollouts around the world are faltering, even in countries where, you know, the vaccines are available. There's a certain reluctance about taking them. And it strikes me that I think we have, you know, quite a ways to go before we're traveling again. And I think when we do start traveling internationally, I think there's going to be a lot of hassles. There's going to be a lot of, you know, COVID testing before you fly. There's going to be a lot of documentation that you're going to need proving your vaccination status and so forth. So I think, you know, we're definitely not out of the woods yet. I can see maybe a bit of light at the end of the tunnel, but I think we still have a bit more to put up with, let's say.
And not everybody's going to make it. Not all those small airlines will make it to the other side.
Yeah, certainly. I could see certainly some more airlines going out of business. I mean, I wouldn't want to name names, but I think, you know, if you're a smaller, undercapitalized carrier that hasn't been able to, you know, raise funds, you know, I think you certainly could be in trouble. But on the flip side, you know, this creates an opportunity. If you're a very powerful airline with, you know, good funding, you know, think about the big American carriers, you know, Singapore Airlines is another one, Qantas, these really strong, well-capitalized carriers. I mean, they'll be in a pretty strong position as we start to emerge from this. So we'll still have airlines, but there might be some, not everybody's going to survive, unfortunately.
Greg, thank you very much indeed. That's Greg Waldron from Flight Global. And this is The Globalist on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Globalist on Monocle 24 with me, Georgina Godwin. Now, podcast listeners can now bring the shows they subscribe to into the Spotify app, which hasn't previously been possible. This major development means multiple new partnerships that'll allow paid shows from third-party platforms and networks. Well, James Cridland is editor of Pod News and joins me now. James, this on the surface sounds quite complicated. How has Spotify worked up until this point?
So up until this point, you've been able to listen to whatever podcast you want to within Spotify, except if you wanted to pay for it. And there are plenty of different podcast publishers which are around and about who would like to charge you to listen to a particular show. And so that's what Spotify unveiled last week, is a way of connecting you with some of the podcasts that you listen to and allowing you to listen to those paid for podcasts within the Spotify app.
So how will it work in practice?
So in practice, it'll work in probably two different ways. So if you are a reader of Der Spiegel, for example, which is a big German newspaper, and you're a paid subscriber to that, then you will be able to press a button and get the podcast that you're paying for within Spotify. A simple pressing a button from your page on the Spiegel website. Or alternatively, there are other ways of doing it. There are a number of different platforms out there called Memberful or Supercast or Supporting Cast, which allow you to, as a podcaster, charge for your individual podcast. And again, the relationship that Spotify announced last week means that if you pay for your podcast within one of these apps, then you'll also be able to have a listen to it within Spotify as well.
And so presumably this will help in the drive to monetize podcasts.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the big difference is that Apple have been doing this sort of thing as well. And Apple, everything goes through the Apple system and you pay 30% of your revenue if you're a podcaster to Apple. And Apple does it in a very Apple way. What Spotify has done is they've done it in a much more open way. So as long as you have this relationship with Spotify, either through your publisher or through one of these services such as Supporting Cast, then you can actually get into Spotify without having to see, somebody taking 30% of your income away.
And so which outlets have signed up for this?
So far, there's a variety of different people, including Mamma Mia, which is a podcast publisher from Australia. Acast is in there. Malcolm Gladwell has an audiobook that you can pay for through the system. And The Motley Fool, which is a financial website as well. But there's also a bunch of other services in there as well, which are, being used by different podcasters across the world. So Glow FM or Supercast or Memberful, those sorts of services, which basically anybody can actually sign up to if you want to sell your own show into Spotify.
Now, there are suggestions that Spotify, whilst great for music, isn't the ideal platform from which to listen to podcasts. How would you respond to that?
I think I'd probably say yes, I would agree, but lots of people are using Spotify to have a listen to all of their audio in one place, and that's the plan that Spotify has. And so clearly what Spotify's ideal is that whatever audio you want to have a listen to, whether it's free or whether it's paid for, you will go and have a listen to it within the Spotify app. That's their plan, and I think, they're not doing a bad job of that so far.
And finally, how do you think this is going to change the wider podcasting landscape?
Well, I mean, I've discovered for today's Pod News that there are more than 1,000 paid shows in Apple Podcasts as well. So I think that, we will certainly see more shows which will be paid for. And the days of completely free podcasts are probably numbered, although numbered for a very small amount of individual shows. I'm not sure that we're going to see an awful lot of shows wanting to charge people directly.
James Cridland, thank you very much indeed for talking to us. And that's all for today's programme, which is still free, although we hope we give you valuable content that you would willingly pay for. Thanks very much to our producers, Alexis Self, Daniel Bache and Charlie Filmer-Court. Our researcher was Sophie Monaghan-Coombs and our studio manager is Christy Evans, with editing assistance from Sean Hickey. After the headlines, there's more music on the way. I'll be hosting the Continental Shift here on Monocle 24 with lots of great programming and, of course, our wonderful international playlist. The Briefing is live at midday in London. And do look out for Meet the Writers. Yesterday we saw the premiere of the latest episode with Jessica Anya Blau. She is a fabulous writer from California. Her latest book, Mary Jane, in the New York Times bestseller list. And she's a wonderful raconteur, so it's well worth listening to that show. I'm Georgina Godwin. I'm going to return on The Globalist at the same time tomorrow. Thank you for listening.